Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you haven't visited a car dealership lately, you might be surprised at the technology now standard in new cars. They aren't driving themselves yet, all things being equal, but they can help motorists watch the road and avoid accidents. And truly autonomous driving is right around the corner. John Quain has written about the new car tech story for the New York Times. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Are we just talking about fancy cars, or are we talking about all kinds of models?
We're talking about all kinds of models now. I mean, it's gotten down to, you know, mass market, the regular kind of sedans that regular people would buy, you know, in the hundreds of thousands of units per year. So you're seeing these connected car systems as kind of the start of it. And people are probably familiar with that, the sort of infotainment so they could play music from their phone through their dashboard. But it's expanded to safety systems, systems that can really save lives. I think systems that can really make a difference for drivers.
We just bought a new-ish car, and we're surprised at how much more affordable it was to insure.
Really? I mean, that's good news. The insurers are still a little bit far behind.
Uh-huh.
I have, you know, in a technology package, if you get some of these advanced safety systems, you may not get a break from the insurer yet. They're not quite, you know, there's not enough data out there for them to say, okay, they've been on the market for a few years, and yes, they are preventing accidents.
Okay.
So until that information comes in, you probably won't see much of a change yet in your insurance.
Let's start with the advanced driver assistance systems. First of all, what do they do?
Well, those systems really take control of the car in a way momentarily. Some you may not be really aware of that they're doing it. They may break a wheel so that you don't swerve around a corner or lose control at a certain speed or on ice. Other systems people might see in advertising, like lane keeping, where the car actually tries to maintain the path down the center of the lane on the highway. And if you start to drift over, it'll actually tug the car a little bit back toward the center of the lane. Systems like that are sort of the baby steps on the way to self-driving autonomous cars.
Is there a demand for this, or why are auto companies doing this?
I mean, there certainly is a demand for some of the technology. Some of it's kind of mandated. Rear-view cameras,
yeah.
The ones that took us years and years of people lobbying it and parents arguing for it until it's finally going to be in cars next year mandatory. That's why you'll see it pretty much standard now, because they're going to be forced to put it in cars. But the other systems, I think, are like emergency braking. I think there is a demand for that, and I think people want that, and there's a voluntary program where a number of automakers have said, yes, they'll try and put it in most of their cars as a standard feature by 2020. But it's not mandatory, unfortunately.
We're talking about very high tech standard in new cars. My guest is John Quain. He's written about this as a contributing writer for the New York Times. We'll have a link to his article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for John Quain, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@WOSU.org. The emergency braking systems, they're becoming standard on new cars. How do they work? What does it feel like when a braking system jumps in ahead of you?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. They're not perfect by any means, but boy, they can really, really help on a long drive, especially I find where there's a lot of fatigue,
yeah,
and stop and go traffic. What they do is they're basically a form of adaptive cruise control, so that they're looking down the highway straight in front of the car or down the road in front of the car, looking for pedestrians, cars they can easily identify. And then if you don't brake within a certain distance, often a flash comes on the screen, emergency or brake, and then if you don't touch the brakes, the car will engage the brakes itself and bring the car to a stop. At certain speeds, say below about 33 miles per hour, it can actually, given the current technology, bring the car to a stop before it hits that object. At higher speeds, of course, it's much more difficult because they're just the laws of physics are involved, and cars take, you know, 100 plus feet to stop. So if somebody steps in front of the car suddenly, it's not magic. It won't prevent you from hitting that. But in the kind of standard traffic that we're in, it really can make a huge difference. And sometimes you'll see it described as collision mitigation, because what they mean is, well, at 65 miles an hour, I can't bring you to a full stop if somebody's just sitting on the highway. However, I can really reduce the impact if you do hit that object.
And when you say the car's looking, you mean literally they have cameras that are looking.
Yes, the standard array is usually a camera and radar looking down the highway. That's, you know, becoming standard again in cars. And once you've already installed that, you can start doing things like looking for lane markings on the side of the road, looking for objects, looking for street signs, looking for speed limit signs, and even saying, oh, the car can see that it's 45 miles an hour and will flash that on your screen. Or if you've got cruise control engaged, some vehicles will slow the car down to 45.
The first car that will have truly autonomous driving in certain road situations is coming this year from Cadillac. What do they have planned?
Right. Well, there's been a lot of hype. You know, people hear about Tesla and other cars on the market, and you know, Volvo, Mercedes, all have systems where you can kind of let the car go for a little bit on its own, but usually only for a few seconds will it drive down the highway, and then it'll force you to put your hands on the wheel. This car, the new Cadillac, it's the CT6, the 2018, will be the very first car where you do not have to put your hands on the wheel or your feet on the gas or the brake at all. You will be able to set it on the highway, and it will literally drive itself down the highway without your intervention. There's no 5-second rule or 15-second where you have to put your hands on the back on the wheel. But there are some limitations. Okay, so it's not on every highway. It's only on highways that they have already mapped using something called LIDAR. And that's a type of laser system. It's much more expensive to use. It's currently more expensive to put in automobiles, so you don't see those systems much, but they will be coming. So the Cadillac won't have LIDAR in it, but it will use those maps that have already been created, very, very detailed maps of these particular highways, knowing exactly where the exit is, exactly where an abutment is, exactly where the edge of the road is. And on those highways, you will be able to set it for what GM calls super cruise, is what they're going to call this feature.
What are those highways going to tend to be, like tollways? You know, the really... What are we talking about?
I think you're going to see mostly, you know, they're not exactly...
Because they show them driving through the mountains and doing something very romantic with these ads.
Right. In this particular case, I don't think so. I mean, they're going to be mostly straight-ahead interstates, you know, that are pretty straightforward. But they'll try and map more and more of these highways as time goes on. They don't let, you know, I asked them if there would be an app to say, well, I'm going to drive from here to Chicago, and I have this car. I would like to have it drive most of the way because it's a very exhausting drive. It's 14 hours. And they're not quite there yet. So they're figuring out how they're going to be able to let drivers do this. But a green light will basically come on your dash and say, this is a highway that you can do this in, you know, engage Super Cruise. So it should be very interesting. Now, there are some other limitations, by the way. It will not pass a car in front of you. So if you come upon, if you're in a lane and you come upon a slower vehicle, it'll slow down and follow that car, but it won't switch lanes and pass it. So there are some things that you need to do on your own. And if something should happen and you don't take control, it'll warn you. It'll gradually slow the car down and stop it. But again, it won't pull the car off to the side of the road. It'll actually stop the car right in the lane you're in.
So stay awake.
Yeah.
How does the autonomous driving from GM and Cadillac compare to what we've seen and heard about? I've only heard about it in Tesla.
Well, those vehicles, again, they don't use LIDAR either, using radar and cameras to look down the road. Mostly they look for lane markings and other hints that they'll see along the road. Sometimes they try to follow also the car in front. So they use a combination of software programs to guess, you know, where I'm going down the lane and can keep you in the lane. The difference with those systems is you're supposed to keep your hands on the wheel. Tesla is extremely explicit about that. You know, I've spoken to them many times. I've tested their vehicles and had the Tesla representative next to me be pretty upset with me when I wasn't keeping my hands on the wheel. So I've tried it, you know, the kinds of things you see on YouTube where you just let the car drive. But it's only for a few seconds. You really are supposed to keep your hands on the wheel. They're not designed yet to do it all by themselves.
And I would imagine it's pretty easy for them to manage. Again, they can tell if your hands aren't on the wheel.
Yes, there are various
sensors,
ways to do
right?
that. Just the sensor in the steering wheel itself.
Yeah.
You can tell whether there's contact or not, whether you're completing an electrical circuit or it's sensitive to your touch. The car knows. And, you know, in all of these systems, they're not perfect. They all tend to wander a little bit in the lane. Whenever I test it, whether it's a BMW or a Volvo, if you let it go, it'll be fine for a while, and then it seems like it's hunting for the edge of the lane, and it'll kind of meander back and forth. You can make them very cautious about that, but if you design a program, you could also make them more human-like, but then it might make mistakes. So that's kind of the problem with designing these systems.
A trend on the horizon is vehicle-to-vehicle communication, where cars are sending signals to each other and working together to avoid collisions. What are they doing? How would that work?
Believe it or not, there are already some vehicles on the market that do this. They just the automakers haven't really talked about it. But there is a protocol for them to send signals to each other. And they even have this big, huge book of hazard ahead, you know, deer, accident, hill, you know, bad weather, ice, all described in this. So some Cadillacs, some Audis can do this and send information to each other. What they do with that information right now isn't much. You might see a warning in a BMW 5 from another BMW 5 car that saw something on the road, the system.
Kind of like a Waze app, but just...
It is, exactly. Okay. Very much so. But they're just one-to-one. In other words, it won't send it to all the Volkswagen people. It won't send it to anybody else. And it may just be a little flashing red light about weather or something ahead. And that's all you'll get. In the future, the idea is once those systems become reliable, that your car may actually start slowing down. You know, if you're on a highway where there are hills and there are many around New York City, you come over a hill and the traffic is stopped. Mm-hmm. Or coming from San Francisco to Oakland, you come around a corner on 101 and the traffic is at a dead stop. Well, you would be warned way in advance of that, and your car would gradually slow down so that you wouldn't have these, you know, emergency braking situations or rear-end collisions.
You wrote about the push to have common standards across auto companies for self-driving cars. What are the challenges there?
Well, there are a lot of challenges, unfortunately. I mean, if you think about technology, in the many years I've covered from PCs, there was sort of a de facto standard. Once there was DOS and Windows and, you know, the IBM PC, it spawned a whole, you know, revolution in technology. The same with smartphones. You basically have a duopoly right now of Android and iOS.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you look at cars and what you have to build and put in them, it's much more computing power than people have had to put in anything before. And if there was a common platform or platforms, just a couple that you could build on, it would make it a lot easier to make changes. It would be more cost effective. And so that is one of the ideas. And right now, engineers and designers are seeing that the old way of making cars and putting them together probably isn't going to work for what will be autonomous vehicles in the future. So that means centralizing a lot of the computing power in that car. And in effect, it'll sort of develop standards along the way. At least that's what people expect.
But for now, they don't want to give up that control.
Well, there's a problem with that. One is I want my vehicles to be different from everybody else's cars. And the other problem is cost effectiveness. They have been used to traditionally having hundreds and hundreds of vendors supply them with parts to build a car. If I start specifically selecting one type of technology over another, that reduces my options. The prices could go up because now I'm subject to, you know, what they want to charge me. And there is also one other issue, and that has to do with security, which hasn't been an issue in cars before this.
Right. Exactly. And I want to get to that. But before I do, another trend is cars that will be able to read our facial expressions.
Yeah.
If a car could recognize us and our moods, what in the world would they do? Who cares?
Well, it did sound really goofy a few years ago when some car companies mentioned this to me, the engineers, I had the same sort of reaction. Why on earth, you know, aside from the fact that it's a bit creepy that they'd be watching me, but the initial reason was I'm trying to look for drowsy drivers, people who are tired. I mean, before you completely fall asleep, if you're tired like that, it's like driving drunk. So it would be a great thing if you could tell a driver they need to pull over, or if you could tell that the driver was becoming drowsy and warn them. That would be one thing. And there was some facial recognition issues there to, you know, the number of times you blink your eyes and where you look and issues like that. But the other side of it is if you're angry, you're probably not the best driver if you're angry. And well short of road rage, the better driver, a safer driver, is a calm driver. So if I could tell some of those visual cues, and then I could do things in the car that might calm you down, that might make you happier and a better driver, then that would be helpful as well.
I'm also thinking, though, that a good sensor on a steering wheel would tell you a lot of information about that kind of stuff.
They do some of that. There was a Volvo system that used what they termed micro corrections. If you, as a driver, are making these little tiny corrections to the wheel and steering all the time, it tends to indicate statistically that you're probably falling asleep or you're distracted. However, unfortunately, it's not true for all drivers. So when they instituted that system, it started to irritate some drivers because that's how they drive. And so that wasn't perfect either. So they use some steering input. They use a camera that often looks at the face of the driver. If you use an infrared camera, you can see through sunglasses and things like that. And if you position the camera properly, so you use a combination of things to tell whether or not the driver is distracted or asleep. And that's going to be more important, too, in trying to hand off a car that, like the Super Cruise, that those GM cars can drive themselves. What happens when the highway ends? How do you give the car back to the driver and make sure they're alert the whole time? So those systems and watching the driver are important.
I did want to talk briefly, at least, about the privacy issue. I mean,
yes,
the cars already collect a ton of data about us that we don't even know. Most of that's to help repair people, you know, when it comes to fixing a car. But is anybody thinking about this?
The car makers are thinking about it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there is a potential for them to, you know, in Silicon Valley terms, monetize that information. There's also a tremendous amount of information that's going to be needed to be collected when cars are driving themselves, especially as they learn, you know, as they gather more data about the road, about the highway, about how a car behaved. You want them to be able to collect all that data and use it to improve the technology. So there's some really good reasons for collecting that. On the other hand, the privacy issues are pretty serious. I know an article I wrote years ago about OnStar, GM's OnStar, changing its terms, upset most people who used OnStar, and then was used in a Supreme Court decision to say there is an expectation of privacy in the car. I mean, it's an odd thing, given that anybody, I can look in your car and see you sitting over there, but people feel like they're private. This is my vehicle, my car, my space.
Well, I can see how the screens could start turning up ads for what's on the, you know, on the next exit, the Wendy's or the McDonald's or whatever.
Sure, and you know it can.
If they know where you're at.
Absolutely, and they would like to do some things like that in, you know, in a way that assumed wouldn't be distracting and might actually be helpful. I mean, maybe I might like it, like I like Amazon to suggest things to purchase. But the idea that these systems know where you are, know which tolls you went through, how fast you were going down the highway, and can track all of that. In fact, you know, there are black boxes in most vehicles now that keep much of that data, because they're required to. Who's able to access that data is still an issue. Should the police get a warrant? Do they need a warrant if there's an accident, something happens? All of those things in the United States, there really aren't any regulations governing most of that. And there are a lot of people touching that information, from the people that collect it, then hand it off to the automakers, because a lot of companies are really keen about collecting that data and sort of sorting through it all and then giving it to the automakers in a way that would be useful to them. That's a whole business unto itself.
John Quain, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Anytime. Happy to be here.
John Quain, contributing writer for The New York Times and contributing editor at Tom's Guide. We'll continue Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A popular photo filter app was recently panned for how it applied what it called a hot filter, which mostly lightened the skin, rounded the eyes, and slimmed the nose. That is, Face App made the subject look whiter. Face App's creator blamed the algorithm. Adrienne Jeffries recently covered the issue in Outline. She joins us by phone. Welcome back.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. Why blame the poor old algorithm?
So, in this case, this is an app that relies on facial recognition. And the way that you train an algorithm to recognize faces is by feeding it lots and lots of faces and sort of letting it figure it out on its own. So, the problem was actually not with the algorithm. The problem was with the training data. That's the term for these huge amounts of data that engineers use to train these algorithms. In this case, basically there was some kind of bias in the training data that associated white European-looking features with attractiveness, and that became reflected in the final product.
Machine learning is what's key here. It's a way for computers to learn without being programmed by humans, I guess. But the data used often comes from the internet, and that's the problem, right?
Right, exactly. So FaceApp is a startup, and for startups, just as for independent researchers or even researchers at universities, they don't have the same kind of access to huge amounts of training data that Google and Facebook and Amazon and the big players do. So what they end up doing is scraping lots of data from the internet, which is a great source because it just has all of this, just tons and tons of information reflects the way humans talk. It's very natural and it's all captured digitally. So
it's
the obvious place to go. And it's free. Yeah, exactly. So what happened is researchers would start scraping, a ton of faces, and then they would make a data set, and then they would publish that data set, and other researchers could use it. The problem is that if there's any kind of bias in this training data set, because it's being shared so many places, that bias ends up spreading really fast and can be hard to notice until you end up with a product that shows some kind of bias. And then that's when you realize your training data was bad.
I guess they didn't test it before putting it out. I mean, or were they oblivious to how the algorithm was working?
Yeah, so they probably did test it. They maybe didn't test it on people with, say, dark skin, or people of Asian descent, or they would have noticed some of the things that the app did that people found very offensive. That's where part of the bias in technology comes in, too, is kind of there's all this inertia around the existing power dynamic that you don't even really notice while you're putting things together that, oh, oops, maybe we should have someone with dark skin on our team so that we can catch this stuff before it goes out into the world.
What has FaceApp done since this kerfuffle over this? It is pretty startling what it does.
Yeah.
I shouldn't call it a kerfuffle. It's pretty serious.
So the first thing that it did was to rename the feature from hot to spark, which is just sort of a meaningless name.
It takes judgment out of it, though.
Right. And the founder said they would be fixing the training data and they would be releasing a new version that would not be enforcing racist beauty standards.
Could you talk a little bit more about machine learning and the different ways it's being used today?
Sure. So machine learning is a very fast way to train algorithms. Like you said, it lets computers sort of teach themselves instead of having to be programmed. So you can imagine for something like facial recognition, it would be very difficult to tell a computer prescriptively what a face looks like. You know, there's like an eye area here and a nose area here, and it's like roughly oval, and you have to program all of that stuff in bit by bit and get it really precise. But instead, researchers have found that it's much faster and more accurate to simply give the algorithm tons and tons of faces and sort of let it deduce what a face is from that. The more data you have, the better. The more differences within the data you have, the better. And that same process can be used for language, natural language processing. So any kind of chatbot is probably being trained with machine learning to make it sound like human speech. Things like self-driving cars also will rely on machine learning. Google has a program where it's teaching an algorithm how to play Go, or actually the algorithm is teaching itself by basically analyzing tons and tons of human Go matches. And part of the unique thing, part of the uniqueness of this approach is that because the algorithm is teaching itself, it's like a black box, what's going on between the time that it gets fed the training data and the time that it produces an output. Mm-hmm. So, like for the Go playing algorithm, which is called AlphaGo, the researchers didn't really know what it was going to do. And they put it up against a human player who was the fourth best ranked player in the world last year or 2 years ago. And the algorithm ended up playing a move that was surprising to everybody. It was like something that when it was played, it was assumed it was a mistake, but it actually turned out to just be so super smart that none of the experts in the room and none of the people who had worked on the algorithm like could tell what it was or could have predicted that the algorithm would do something like that. Mm-hmm. So it can become kind of difficult to figure out how your machine is going to turn out when you train it this way.
You know, and that's interesting because the goal is to beat somebody else and the computer is taking everything it knows and everything it's learned and doing that. And it's going to be super smart. We know that about computers. But how does a computer start to make judgment calls like it did with FaceApp?
So it's not making any kind of judgment call. All it's doing is imitating what it's been taught. So for the story that I wrote about this, I interviewed one machine learning consultant who gave an example of when he wrote his own facial recognition algorithm, and he didn't realize until after he tested it on his kids that his training data only contained adult faces. So it worked fine as long as it was trying to pick out an adult face, but when he tested it on his kids, the algorithm didn't even recognize that they were faces.
Really?
So it's really, yeah, it's just replicating what it knows. Whatever is in the training data, that's what it gets. And sometimes if there are blind spots in the training data, unless you're really deliberate about vetting this data before putting it into the algorithm, you can end up with these unexpected results and unexpected blind spots.
How can programmers combat this bias, especially if they're pulling data from the internet because they're a startup and that's the only way they can afford to do it?
Yeah, so lots of people are working on that question. I don't think that there is a consensus about the solution. I think it comes down to being careful about where you get your data. There are also ways to weight algorithms to make them more fair. So if you don't have a ton of a certain type of person or item in your data set, you can weight the ones you have more so that in order to counter the fact that you don't have a representative sample. But all of this is kind of still being discussed. It's a very new industry. Machine learning took off like in 2006, and it's just now being deployed widely. So I think it's something that researchers are still really struggling with figuring out how to deal with.
You said that there are data sets available that don't contain any bias. Yes or no?
So it's pretty tough to say there's no bias in a data set. I think you can, you know, there are methods for taking the bias and attempting to, taking the training data and attempting to correct for some kind of bias.
Right.
Which is what some engineers are working on. I think it's pretty tough to find a bias-free data set. I mean, if you are designing your own data set, if you're someone like Google or Facebook, or you're a university who has a lot of funding for a particular project, and you can build your own data set, then you have a lot more ability to design it so that it has a representative number of people from each racial group or people from every age, or, you know, if it's different kinds of Go matches, like you make sure that you get them from every level. Like if you're designing the training data yourself and you have lots of funding to do it the right way, then you can, I think, get reasonably close to a pretty fair data set. If you're scraping this thing from the internet, mm-hmm. it gets a lot harder.
And ultimately, it's only as strong as the humans that look at the output in the end and decide that it's okay to put out there.
Right. That too, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Adrian Jeffries, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Definitely. Thank you.
It's Adrian Jeffries, tech editor for The Outline. More Tech Tuesday coming up with Russell Holley. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Superhero fans are looking forward to the release of the next Guardians of the Galaxy movie. The first film was popular in part because of its classic rock soundtrack, like Mr. Blue Sky by Electric Light Orchestra. Doritos partnered with Marvel Studios to create an unusual promotional item for the film and its soundtrack. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So what did Doritos do cook up for the Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2?
Yeah, so there was a special version of one of their bags of chips. And if you go to any grocery store right now, you'll see all of the Doritos have Guardians of the Galaxy branding across all of it. It's been there for a couple of weeks now. You can see it pretty much anywhere. But this was a special version of the bag of chips that was sold on Amazon that you... it said right on the page, you could plug your headphones into the bag and listen to the soundtrack for the new movie.
I mean, I'm just trying to visualize this. There was like an outlet
really
in the bag. Did you get one?
Yeah. No, I didn't get one. There's a 3.5 millimeter jack, you know, a normal headphone jack, you know, on the bag. And the front of the bag looks like, you know, looks like the Walkman that Star-Lord uses in the movie. With, you know, the name of the next track, the next album, rather, on it. And so you plug in, and there's basically a little MP3 player that's sitting on the inside of the bag. There's still a bag of potato chips in there, or rather a bag of Doritos in there.
Yeah.
But you, you know, you plug the headphones in, and you press play on what looks like, you know, a Walkman, and the music starts playing.
Wow. They sold out.
They sold out really fast, and a lot of them, unfortunately, to scalpers. You can still get one if you're willing to pay way too much money on eBay right now.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, they are they sold out very, very quickly.
What do you think the appeal is?
I think mostly it's a, you know, it's kind of a gimmick thing. This isn't the first time you know, a company has done stuff like this recently. KFC has been doing things all over the world where, you know, they've had kind of silly things that have pulled in a smartphone or headphones or something like that. There was one that actually had a keyboard that was on the placemat where the food got put, and you could actually connect your phone via Bluetooth to this paper keyboard and use it to send messages while you were eating at this KFC. It's a lot of really bizarre, you know, kind of these temporary pieces of hardware that are being tested in a bunch of different markets, really just to see how people react to strange things like, you know, your placemat being able to send text messages or your bag of chips being able to play music.
You know, you said around the world. Is this more popular in other places?
There have been more examples of it in other places. I know that there have been tests in Germany and France. This is the first really large test that was done specifically oriented to the U.S., but it's definitely not going to be the last. I think the biggest problem with doing something like this in the U.S. is scale. Unless you're, targeting specific restaurants or chains or something in specific areas, or just going through Amazon, it's really hard to do across the entire country.
I really enjoyed Guardians of the Galaxy, but I'm not, like a super fan. I'm not real familiar with every little nuance in it. What does Doritos have to do with it? Was there any connection at all?
Not really.
Okay.
Doritos wasn't even a popular brand when the main character was on Earth.
Snatched from Earth, right.
The 80s. So, yeah, it's, it was really just, Doritos saw an opportunity there and decided to hurl, I'm sure, an obscene amount of money at Marvel Studios to try and sell some more potato chips.
You know, it really makes you wonder what we've come to when you could put an MP3 player into a bag of chips, right?
Right. And this, it's the kind of thing where, the touch technology is definitely there, and it's not hard to have, kind of a small battery with a storage device that's no bigger than a flash drive.
Mm-hmm.
But, being able to put it in that container and make it look like it's something else, kind of gives you that nostalgic kick, because it did look like a cassette player.
Oh, it did.
Yeah, the whole front of the bag looked like a Sony Walkman cassette player. And then you went and you had to physically press the play button on the bag in order to get the music to play after you plugged in the headphones. So they spent a lot of time, on the inside it was very much just a generic MP3 player in a very small silver package. But on the outside, the packaging for the bag looked like a Sony Walkman cassette player.
Okie doke. You think there'll be more of this?
I'm sure we will see more of this, if not this year, then early next year, because we're going to have not only more stuff from Marvel coming over the next couple of years, but, things from some DC Comics and other things like that are going to appeal to this particular market. We may even see something with the new Star Wars coming at the end of the year.
Yeah, that's right. By the way, I mean, Guardians of the Galaxy particularly lends itself to this because the main character, pretty much all he takes with him when he's nabbed is this cassette player with a bunch of songs on it.
Yeah, in a world right now where everything seems to be a nostalgia play for 80s and 90s kids, this movie was in the comic book series that inspired it was built on that premise that this person who was a child of the 80s came back to Earth and all of these things were new and odd.
Windows and Acer have unveiled a new headset. It's not just a virtual reality of augmented reality. They're calling it mixed reality. Oh, my gosh. What is going on here?
So this is largely a marketing term, and it's something that we're going to hear a lot of from Microsoft, especially over the next couple of weeks, because their Build conference is next week, and they're going to explain this in a little further detail. But essentially, it's a virtual reality headset that's going to work specifically with Microsoft's Windows 10 Creators Update. And what makes it special is it has several cameras built into the front of the headset that's similar in nature to the Microsoft HoloLens product project that had been in development last year. And so this is going to be a headset that is relatively inexpensive compared to what the other options are. You're going to be able to put it on, and the steps that you take in the real world are going to have an impact in the virtual world, such that you'll be able to kind of reach out and touch your actual walls and interact with things kind of like you would with HoloLens.
Right. HoloLens, how does it differ from that?
Well, HoloLens was an entirely contained system. It had its own computer built in. It ran on its own battery. It didn't connect to anything. And as a result, was very expensive and still is very expensive. This is designed to connect to your existing computer and use your existing computer as the brain for everything. And as a result, is only going to start at $350.
Only $350.
When you consider HoloLens was $3,000, right, and the HTC Vive is $800.
I know.
It is definitely still a lot of money, but comparatively much less.
What's it like to use it?
A lot of it really is, taking this Windows, what they call this mixed reality experience, is very much, kind of sitting at a desk and seeing The same basic dimensions of your room. You look around and you can see the walls and everything are in the same place, but you have a lot of control over what lives on those walls. So mm-hmm. if you want, a Twitter feed to live just above your monitor or something like that, then you can have those things happen. And when you're playing games or exploring apps, they're happening, kind of physically in front of you, where you can reach out with your hand and interact with them, instead of just being on a flat screen.
So you could sit there and be waving your arms around and doing something.
That's the general idea. What we haven't heard from Microsoft yet, and what we're hoping to hear more of this coming week, is how the kind of hand interaction stuff is going to work. Because a lot of what we've seen so far is using just an Xbox controller to do a lot of the controls. And, compare that to what we have with, Sony and HTC and Oculus, where they have, really interactive touch environments. Microsoft is going to need to explain that a little bit to make it as valuable, as far as going in and actually using it.
When do you expect it to be available for consumers? You said it's the conference that's coming up is for people to develop things like this, right?
Yes, we're going to see a big push from Microsoft over the next 2 weeks to really encourage developers to try and build new things for it. And it's going to work directly with the same kind of technology that HoloLens is using. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the HoloLens apps will, then come and work on this platform as well. But we probably won't see this for people to spend money on until the summer.
Okay. Speaking of the summer, as it approaches, waterproof outdoor speakers are becoming a big deal. Now, there have been outdoor speakers for a long time, so what's different here?
The biggest thing, this is a big push that we've seen this year, is that, waterproof outdoor speakers are not a new thing, but these are, like all, speakers that connect to your phone, they're getting smaller, they're getting louder, and they're getting a whole lot more in the way of battery power. And so we've seen several really nice outdoor speakers that are designed to, survive things like a spontaneous rainstorm or accidentally be tossed into a pool. Things like that, that are pretty reasonably priced and have batteries that will last for several hours and are more than loud enough to be the kind of speaker that you would actually want to take outside instead of just using the speaker on your phone.
So loud enough, but what about the quality of sound?
It's going to vary from speaker to speaker, and a lot of the companies that are getting involved now are starting to make speakers that they've had a lot of experience with, outdoor quality speakers in the past, like JBL, for example. The, mm-hmm. the JBL Charge 3 speaker is designed to work outside and designed to survive, pretty much direct immersion with water. And JBL speakers have been, high quality speakers in the industry for a long time, and so you get that with the audio experience there. Plus, that speaker in particular was kind of interesting because the battery is large enough that not only can it run itself, but it can also charge your phone. If you get to a certain point in the day and your battery is dead, you can actually plug it into the speaker and have it charge it.
What should people consider when choosing a waterproof speaker if they're in the market?
The biggest thing to keep in mind for a waterproof speaker is to know the difference between waterproof and water resistant. That you'll see those two used in describing packaging. Water resistant means that it can handle splashes and there won't be any significant problems. Waterproof means that it can actually be fully submerged in water and not have any substantial damage to it. If you fully submerge a water resistant speaker, there's still a pretty significant chance that it will come out damaged. And a lot of times you'll see things claiming to be outdoor speakers that are water resistant that don't actually have in their warranty language that covers water damage. So the biggest thing there is to keep an eye on that.
And as far as how close, does it matter how close you are to it for the Bluetooth connection to work?
It's going to vary from phone to phone and from speaker to speaker, but most Bluetooth connections with modern phones will get you, when you're outside, between 10 and 15 feet with no problem, no quality loss or anything like that. There are newer speakers and newer phones that can get you up to 20 to 25 feet before you notice any stuttering or anything with the audio.
And is there a difference? Should people consider different things if they want a speaker for the shower versus, the pool?
Again, that comes to, water resistance versus waterproofing. Your water resistant is probably fine for the shower unless you have it directly in, the shower way.
Yeah.
Whereas waterproof is something you're probably going to want if you're specifically looking for something poolside.
Cool. We talked about car technology a little earlier in the show, and you wanted to talk about a new car from Ford that has Amazon's digital assistant Alexa built in. Tell us about how drivers could take advantage of Alexa if they're driving. That's the 2017 Ford Fusion Energy, right?
Yeah, so this 2017 Ford Fusion Energy is the first to have Alexa built in, and it's a little different from the Alexa that you have in your home in that it has a few more options for things like turn-by-turn navigation and finding, say, the next closest gas station or something like that. And the same basic principle here applies, where you can be driving and you say, Alexa, how do I do this thing? And the answer will, either come out through the speakers in the car or be available in the display panel that is, built into the car's dash.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole idea here is being able to use Alexa in the same way that you would consider using Alexa at home, but with these kind of specific car features.
Well, and also Amazon's not doing this just out of the goodness of its heart to provide a new cool technology. They want to sell you stuff too, right?
Oh, absolutely. This is Amazon is their recommendation engine is built entirely on, partnerships that they've made. And, this being a car that has it's an electric car, so there's, charging stations that it can direct you to. And mm-hmm. It's never going to make direct suggestions to you as far as, things it thinks you should buy. But it's going to use that information tied to your Amazon account to make recommendations when you go to Amazon.
Like how? Like, what do you mean?
Well, so right now, if you have Alexa at home and you ask questions about specific products, you will see the next time you go to Amazon, you will see, kind of recommendations based on those products.
Oh, yeah.
Looking through your results on Amazon. And so a lot of that same stuff is going to appeal. Plus, Amazon's Prime Music service and the Audible book service and, all of those, kind of online services that stream all of the content that you can get normally through Amazon at home, you would then obviously be able to get through here in the car as well.
Now, if you're not into Amazon Alexa, you can use competing products from Apple and Google too, right?
Yeah. So Ford has the way that they build their kind of in-car system, it has a connection software for both Apple's CarPlay and Android Auto. And those both work in such a way that you plug the phone in and it basically takes the information from your phone and puts it on the display. And so a lot of that information will end up being there as well. But the Amazon service is designed to just be completely integrated into the car and doesn't require you to connect a phone.
And what more can drivers look forward to in the future with this type of technology?
Well, a lot of the things that, Ford in particular has been trying to figure out with, just kind of cramming as many different options into the car as possible is trying to figure out what the big thing is that most people want these features for. And a lot of times you see, car safety being the big thing, where instead of people looking down at phones, they have, messages being spoken to them or, calendar alerts being spoken to them, or as is the case with this car, being able to have kind of an automatic navigation to whatever the next charging station is if your battery ends up being low. And so that, I think, is the big thing here. It's not so much a particular feature as it is automating the things that Ford knows that people are doing in their cars.
I'm kind of wondering, as far as what you do, Russell, following technology, so much of it there's a big push toward the car now, right? I mean, are you going to have a lot of cars for your kids to drive as they're growing up?
No, this is, there is a lot of push to have all of this stuff in the car, but a lot of this stuff is still very similar. So it's not like, this is one of the few examples where what Ford is doing is going to be, slightly different from what it is that, Chevy is doing with their in-car system,
mm-hmm.
But only for a little while. So it's never going to be the kind of thing where the entire, as weird as this is to say, the entire car operating system is going to be radically different,
mm-hmm.
because the general idea for those systems is for it to be kind of as ubiquitous as possible.
Russell Holley, thank you as always. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
That's Russell Holley, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.